In California, the state Supreme Court has ruled that illegal immigrants can continue to pay in-state tuition at public colleges and universities. The ruling is controversial. Critics say it benefits students who shouldn't be there in the first place. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The court ruling affects students like 20-year-old John. He's asked us not to use his surname because he's worried about revealing his immigration status. He's a bright-faced freshman at a junior college in the San Francisco Bay Area.
My mom is Filipino and my dad's El Salvadorian, and they met in Canada, and that's where they gave birth to me.
John's family came to the United States, where he attended California schools. By the time he graduated from high school 2 years ago, his undocumented status left him in a quandary. His mother was ill, and he was broke.
I didn't think I could go to college, so it was just really depressing. I didn't know what I could do here. I was thinking about moving back to Canada, but at the same time, we have no money and no family in Canada, so my options were so limited. I was really depressed.
But through friends and mentors, John learned he could afford a local junior college by paying an in-state tuition rate. That's a discount available under California law to anyone who attends high school here for at least 3 years. That law took effect 8 years ago, says Ethan Schulman, an attorney who successfully defended it before the state Supreme Court.
The law on its face makes no distinction on the basis of residence, and it makes no distinction on the basis of immigration status. It simply refers to students who have attended high school for 3 or more years in our state and graduated.
The law was challenged on behalf of 42 out-of-state students who sued the University of California because they are charged a higher rate of tuition. In-state tuition at UC campuses is $10,300. Out-of-state students are charged $33,000. Attorney Michael J. Brady says the California law is in conflict with a federal law that says illegal immigrants may not receive benefits based on residency or benefits unavailable to U.S. citizens.
Because the federal law clearly indicated the intention of Congress to stop states from granting discounted or in-state tuition to unlawful aliens.
But the attorney for the university, Ethan Schulman, says since illegal immigrant students are ineligible for any kind of financial aid, in-state tuition rates are a small break.
Most of these students are students who come from very reduced economic circumstances. Their parents are cleaning our offices and working in our fields. To expect them to be able to pay out of their own pockets without any benefit of financial aid that's available to everybody else is unrealistic in the extreme.
The California Supreme Court ruling was unanimous. That could discourage legal challenges in other states where illegal immigrant students pay in-state tuition. But critics such as Michael J. Brady say they have every intention of appealing to the U.S. Supreme Court. Richard Gonzalez, NPR News, San Francisco.
All Things Considered is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. To find out more about the books and authors you hear on NPR's programs, go to npr.org/books. There you'll find author interviews, NPR's bestseller lists, and find out what our staff is reading. This is NPR. Now to a new development in the foreclosure mess. For the first time, there's talk of a compensation fund for people who lost their homes in foreclosures that should not have happened. State officials have been investigating sloppy paperwork at the nation's biggest lenders, and the banks acknowledge they made mistakes with some foreclosures. As NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports, there are big questions about how a compensation fund would work.
Think of the fund set up for victims who died in the September 11th terror attacks, or BP's compensation fund set up to help those affected by the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. This one would benefit those who could prove that they wrongfully lost their home because of bank errors. Jeff Greenwood is spokesman for the Iowa Attorney General. He says that is just one of the things the state attorneys general are considering in discussions with all the major lenders.
We've made no secret that there should be a remedy for what has occurred. We're still in that phase of trying to figure out how extensive this is, but we do know that once we get our arms around it, then we need to address it. We need to come up with remedies.
Greenwood says compensation fund discussions are at an early stage. Nothing, including its size, has been determined. But the AGs are also considering appointing an independent monitor to oversee bank handling of foreclosures. But do the banks support the idea of a fund? Greenwood is not entirely sure.
I'm sure they have concerns about this whole process.
Representatives from Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Ally Financial, an NPR underwriter, declined to speak on tape. They said they're discussing the investigation and possible remedies, but declined comment on the idea of a victims fund. Earlier this month, J.P. Morgan appointed an independent monitor. Iowa Attorney General spokesman Jeff Greenwood said each foreclosure case is complex, that discussions involve different interests of the states, as well as lenders and loan servicers.
I can't begin to tell you the number of challenges that we are facing in this situation.
He says no decision is imminent. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. We'll report next on the story of one unemployed American. It's a story you could likely repeat millions of times.
The upside for Americans out of work right now is that companies are slowly hiring again. The downside is that Americans out of work may not be at the front of the line for those new jobs.
The very fact of being unemployed may be a disadvantage. Some employers are not eager to hire the close to 25 million Americans who are out of work or underemployed. That includes this experienced worker who spoke with NPR's John Itzde.
Until he got laid off more than 2 years ago, Michael Hall was a road warrior.
I would leave my home here in California about 3 a.m. To catch a flight and get home Friday around midnight.
In between, he'd often make 8 more airline connections as he flew around the country.
Yeah, pretty hardcore.
Hall's job was demonstrating high-tech equipment for data and phone networks. His hard work, engineering training, and social skills helped him pull down a solid 6-figure income. But now Mike Hall, who's 50 years old and single, spends most of his time looking for work. He says he's applied for well over 1,000 jobs. Every 3 months or so, he manages to get an interview, but so far, no luck. He says he knows it's not personal.
But try telling that to some kid who asked every single girl to the prom in his high school. And they all said no. After a while, being told that you're not desired or wanted that many times, it might start to sink in, but you try to block it out.
Hall says he mostly manages to remain hopeful, but he's really troubled by one thing: the prejudice many hiring managers seem to hold against the unemployed.
Two specifically came right out and said, we don't like to hire people that are unemployed. And one followed that with, so why are you still unemployed, in almost an indignant manner, which seemed kind of insulting. And the obvious answer is, well, because people like you don't like to hire unemployed people.
This is a common complaint from unemployed workers, that employers only want to hire people who already have jobs. And there's a view that there must be something wrong with you if you're unemployed. Chris Schaublock, CEO of West Coast Careers, a recruiting and staffing company, confirms those perceptions. And he says he absolutely has clients who tell him they don't want him to hire unemployed workers. Schaublock thinks there are legitimate reasons behind that strategy.
If you think about the talent in that unemployed market, you would realize that companies rarely lay off their best skilled workers.
So, says Schaublock, it's not surprising that some companies don't want to hire the unemployed.
It's people that aren't top performers. So if you're ABC Corporation and you're trying to hire the best salesperson out there and you're looking at unemployed people, it might not be the group of people with the best skills.
Mike Hall says when he hears that, it makes him feel like an outcast.
It sounds and it really feels like society wants you to voluntarily walk out onto the ice floe. And I'm not ready for that. I'm too young to pack it all in. I've got a lot yet to offer.
In fact, some other staffing experts have pointed out that given the massive layoffs in the economy, the chances of finding top performers in the current pool of unemployed workers is probably higher than at any time in recent memory. And there may be another reason for companies to make sure they consider the unemployed.
It's quite possible that discriminating against somebody because they're unemployed is illegal.
Judy Conte represents the National Employment Law Project, an advocacy group for low-income and unemployed workers. She acknowledges there's no specific statute protecting unemployed individuals, but Conte says because people of color who are protected against discrimination have higher than average unemployment rates, an argument could be made that refusing to consider unemployed people for jobs is illegal.
With record high levels of unemployment and with people being out of work for so long now, clearly this problem and this prejudice is growing.
Conte's organization has brought the issue to the attention of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and she says the Black and Hispanic caucuses are also preparing letters urging the commission to take quick action on the issue. John Idstey, NPR News, Washington.
Let's go next to Arizona, where 98 patients approved for organ transplants have been told they're not getting transplants. The patients are on Arizona's version of Medicaid, and the state is trying to close a big budget deficit. NPR's Ted Robbins has this report on what's being called an unprecedented denial of medical service.
Oh, right up the middle. Nice one.
Randy Shepard is 36 years old and 6'3", but he has to toss baseballs to his 3-year-old son Nathan while sitting down in a lawn chair. He has cardiomyopathy. His heart muscle is deteriorating. It's the result of rheumatic fever he had as a child. He had his heart valves replaced as a teenager, but that was 20 years ago.
The muscles gotten tired and distended and the muscles worn out.
You can hear the weakness in his voice, even though doctors implanted a pacemaker in 2008. They've told Randy Shepard that he needs a heart transplant to survive. ACCESS, the Arizona Healthcare Cost Containment System, is the state's Medicaid program. It was the only health insurance Shepard could get because he had a pre-existing condition and he had little money since he was forced to stop working in his plumbing business. ACCESS authorized his transplant more than a year ago.
July 23rd of 2009 was the date they officially put me on the list.
And by this summer, he'd moved up to the top of the transplant list.
My nurse, who's the transplant coordinator, did tell me about 2 months ago that I'm the next one of my body size and blood type, so the next one that's available is mine.
It was his. Facing a $1.5 billion budget deficit, Arizona cut out all state-funded lung transplants, some bone marrow transplants, and some heart transplants, including for the condition Randy has.
Well, as of October 1st, due to the budget cuts, ACCESS has said they're unable to pay for the transplant.
It's not unusual for private insurance companies or government agencies to change eligibility requirements for medical procedures ahead of time. But medical ethicists say authorizing a procedure, then reversing that decision, is unheard of.
To basically renege on what you promised was going to be a chance at life is a very, very bitter indictment of the ethics of the legislature.
Arthur Kaplan is head of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. He calls the reversal awful behavior because Arizona is going back on a covenant it made with its patients. And also, he says, because these are patients for whom time is critical, patients who spent months, years, thinking they were covered.
They then stop trying to raise money, stop trying to see what Uncle Fred might be willing to give them. They don't have the bake sale. They don't make the appeal in church.
The state says the cuts will save about $4.5 million this year. No one from ACCESS would agree to an interview, but the state agency provided us with the data it gave to the legislature. It shows the procedures have poor outcomes, that most patients die after the transplants. But critics say that data was cherry-picked. It only included ACCESS's own patients and only for a 2-year period. A coalition of transplant centers, including the University of Arizona and the Mayo Clinic, recently gave the state more data showing better outcomes. State Representative John Kavanaugh is on the House Appropriations Committee in the Arizona Legislature. He looked at the new information.
It's a terrible situation, but we don't want anybody to die because of a faulty data set. So if we made a mistake, then we're going to reinstate those that require it.
Kavanaugh is promising a hearing when the Arizona legislature convenes in January. He says the state can cut money somewhere else. Meanwhile, one patient has found a private bone marrow donor. Randy Shepard says he and his wife were bitter when they first learned approval for his new heart was taken away. But they've learned to appreciate the time and the medical procedures he's already had.
If I were to die because they didn't give me the transplant, I've had the last 18 months with my kids that I would not have had otherwise because Access paid for my pacemaker.
Now on disability through Social Security, Randy Shepard will become eligible for Medicare next year. That gives him some hope, whatever the Arizona legislature does. 96 other patients wait. Ted Robbins, NPR News.
Ted's one of scores of NPR correspondents you hear from across America on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Last night, a surprising twist on ABC's Dancing with the Stars. America voted off
Brandy and Max.
That's right, R&B singer Brandy and Max, her professional dance partner, had been toe-to-toe in the competition with Dirty Dancing's Jennifer Grey and her partner, but Brandy was voted off last night. Instead, Bristol Palin, daughter of Sarah Palin, moved on, despite having consistently low scores from the judges.
Bristol's Argentine tango was precise but lacked intensity, keeping her near the bottom of the leaderboard for the sixth week in a row.
We thought that we would get an outside opinion of last night's result from internationally acclaimed ballroom dancer and dance instructor Pierre Dulaine. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. And nice to be here.
I should say that Mr. Dulaine joins us from New York. You watched the results. Where were you and what was your immediate reaction to the result?
Well, I was at home actually watching television. I was so shocked. My words were unbelievable.
You were moved actually to email your dance instructors?
Yes, we have many, many sites that do our work, you know, for the children, and I emailed everybody. I said, unbelievable, Bristol Palin in. I just can't believe it.
To a trained eye, you would say it was unquestionable that Brandy had danced better?
Much, much, much better. With all due respect to Miss Palin, I mean, I think she has done wonderful by staying in so many weeks and learning everything she learned, and she certainly improved from where she started. But as she said herself, she's not a dancer.
As a dance instructor, what are you talking about? What are you seeing that says to you, vote that woman off the show?
Basically, I mean, she followed her partner quite nicely enough, I suppose, but her shoulders were up. She had I'm being very honest here, a dull face many times. Smiling was hard for her. Her technique was not good at all. She just walked across the stage with the steps that were given to her with difficulty. And certainly for me, not pleasant to watch when you compare it to the other two ladies.
You teach kids how to dance, I wonder if you could give Bristol Palin some advice, since she's a relative newcomer to all this, and since she's going to be in the final anyway, what would you say?
If she does get through to be a winner, then I would be horrified. That I would even be more horrified than last night. But what I would tell her to do, I suppose, is to try and relax. Her shoulders are up in her ears and to smile a bit more, to be natural about it. At the moment, just go for it. Just enjoy it. Just live the last few moments and, you know, go on.
Pierre Dulaine, thank you very much for talking
thank
with us
sir.
About this. Pierre Dulaine runs Dancing Classrooms. It's a program that teaches kids to dance. Dancing Classrooms was the subject of the 2005 documentary Mad Hot Ballroom.
According to you, I'm stupid, I'm useless, I can't do anything right. According to you, I'm difficult, hard to please, forever changing my mind. I'm a mess in a dress, can't show up on time, even if it will save my life. According to you, according to you.
Moral Things Considered coming up right after this.
And our sports commentator Frank DeFord has been thinking about how you play the game.
By now, you may be among the millions of people who've seen on YouTube the trick football play pulled off by the Driscoll Middle School of Corpus Christi, Texas. If you've been watching President Obama abroad or otherwise wasting your time, here's what happens. Driscoll breaks out of the huddle and the quarterback lines up over the ball. From the sideline, the assistant coach calls out that Driscoll deserves a 5-yard penalty. At this point, the Driscoll center casually hands the ball over his shoulder to the quarterback. Now, this is perfectly acceptable, even though we know that the center invariably delivers the ball through his legs. The quarterback then takes the ball and starts to walk off 5 yards himself, as the opponents look on confused. Then, clear of the opposition, the quarterback suddenly breaks into a run and dashes 67 yards for a touchdown. The play is legal, and just about everybody who's seen it gets a real hoot out of it. In one online poll, a huge number of those who voted said the play was genius. Well, it isn't, and it isn't funny, and it isn't right. Sure, athletes often employ gamesmanship, and now I will give you a lecture on Situational Ethics Sports Division. Remember the summer when Derek Jeter, the All-American boy, idol of millions, faked getting hit by a pitch and his acting was so good he was awarded first base? Well, Jeter is a grown-up playing other grown-ups in a game umpired by grown-ups. So are wide receivers who pretend to catch a pass that really hit the ground first, and basketball players who flop back as if they were fouled. Just like the Driscoll Middle School quarterback, it is perfectly legal to act in a game. But the players who do that in the pros are not embarrassing the opposition. They're just trying to con the umpire. It's a benign bit of hustle that would have made for some good Aesop's fables if old Aesop were still around writing a sports blog nowadays. But the Driscoll team didn't act instinctively to try and put one over on a ref. The middle schoolers didn't even come up with the ruse themselves. Their coach dreamed up the play and even participated in it, hollering from the sideline. The referees weren't victimized. In fact, they had to play along. No, it was only the other team's kids who were embarrassed and belittled by a children's coach being a wise guy, a bully of sorts. It wasn't genius at all. Rather, it was a form of child abuse. Sure, it was legal, but it wasn't fair. Laugh at kids being outslicked by a grown-up, and you're cruel. That isn't sport.
Commentator Frank DeFord joins us each Wednesday from our member station WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montagne.